Hi, I'm Larry Levin, president of the St. Louis Civic Orchestra, and I'm here today with our maestro, artistic director Ed Dolbashian, to talk about our concert on Saturday, February 23rd at 7 p.m. at Logan University in their beautiful Purser Hall. That's in Chesterfield. And it's featuring both the St. Louis Civic Orchestra and our very special guests, T.J. Muller and the Gaslight Squares Jazz Band. For information and tickets, visit our website, stlco.org, and follow our Facebook page. Ed, thanks for visiting today.
A pleasure to be with you.
And for our listeners, St. Louis Civic is an ensemble of more than 60 community musicians who come together to perform some of the great symphonic musical literature for five concerts each season, which runs from October to May. We've been in existence for 70 years, and we'll be celebrating that anniversary this coming year. So in February, we have a very fun and somewhat different program planned. It's chock full of amazing American music, jazz music, dance music, movie music, including works by George Gershwin and Leonard Bernstein. And if, as if that weren't enough, our special guests, T.J. Muller and the Gaslight Squares, will perform their own brand of traditional jazz, blues, and ragtime, and will even join the orchestra for some music as well. But let's get back to Gershwin and talk about American in Paris. Lots of our listeners, Ed, know about the great movie from 1951, which, by the way, came out just a couple of years after our orchestra was formed. Tell us about what you find so compelling about this George Gershwin score and what makes it so enjoyable both to conduct and to listen to.
This American in Paris by Gershwin is a wonderful, wonderful orchestral work. And it's not actually based on a specific story. Mm-hmm. And as I was studying the score and reading about it, fortunately, Gershwin, in his own words, describes the music. Mm-hmm. And it might be a good idea just to read what he had to say.
Sure.
About his own piece. And what he said is this: "This new piece, really a rhapsodic ballet, is written very freely and is the most modern music I've yet attempted. An American in Paris opens with music depicting the protagonist strolling throughout Paris." And in parentheses, he says, Gershwin went to great time and expense to find authentic French taxi horns for inclusion in the work's premiere. Later, according to Gershwin, our American friend, perhaps after strolling into a cafe and having a couple of drinks, has succumbed to a spasm of homesickness. But finally, the homesick American, having left the cafe and reached the open air, has disowned his spell of the blues and once again is an alert spectator of Parisian life. At the conclusion, the street noises and French atmosphere are triumphant." And that's Gershwin's own words. And that, I couldn't say it any better.
So one of the most amazing things that Gershwin was able to do was incorporate these three kind of genres, the symphonic music, jazz music, and dance music,
right,
in such innovative ways. So we may now take it for granted because it's been around for a while. But what made it so new and compelling at the time?
Well, it was written for a full symphony orchestra, which most jazz at that time was written for big band, mm-hmm, so to speak. And although he does call for a saxophone section, mm-hmm, and all these authentic sound effect instruments from that he heard in Paris. And as he said, he went out and he loved that taxi sound so much, he went out and purchased at great expense of several of those taxi horns to bring back to use in the premiere, which took place in 1928.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the wonderful things about it. It's jazz with a full symphony orchestra.
And just so our audience knows, if you are entertaining coming to see us, we indeed will have taxi horns for the performance.
I hope so.
They're on the way.
Great.
But talk about what that grand percussion section does for the piece. I mean, it's pretty large percussion.
Well, it does very well to give you a sense of street sounds, mm-hmm, of traffic, of lights, of people talking, of all the noises that take place in a big city. Gershwin manages to put into a sonorous effect with an orchestra.
Right. And many people, of course, also know Rhapsody in Blue. What are some of your favorite Gershwin, either tunes or orchestral pieces that maybe other people don't, you know, find to be
well,
on
Well, Rhapsody
there?
In Blue is great.
Yeah.
I mean, that really catapulted him to the world stage,
mm-hmm.
Writing a work for solo piano,
mm-hmm.
With jazz elements,
mm-hmm.
Backed by, as he transcribed it later, for a full symphony orchestra.
Yeah.
And of course, Porgy and Bess,
mm-hmm.
is one of the great creations of the of that time.
Have you had occasion to conduct that?
I've conducted some of it,
uh-huh.
in concert, and sort of a reduced concert version,
mm-hmm.
of it, where the filling was done through narration,
mm-hmm.
and we played all the major tunes of the of that little opera.
It's amazing the amount of tunes, melodies, motifs that of Gershwin that have kind of infiltrated popular culture, right?
Oh yeah.
I mean, including United Airlines commercials, right? but it's really kind of systemic throughout.
Well, yeah, he was, and it's a shame that he passed away so young.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was only 37, yeah. or something like that.
Yeah.
Very, very, very young, and you can just imagine what he would have written.
Oh my goodness!
The great music we'd have today had he lived long.
Kind of the Mozart comparable.
I was going to just say, like Mozart dying so young, Mendelssohn dying, mm-hmm. so young, the huge amount of musical output these composers could have created.
Right.
It's just you always just sit there and wonder.
And then we shift to Leonard Bernstein and the dance episodes from On the Town. So more jazz and more dance.
More jazz, more dance, written back in, I guess, 1944.
Right, and for originally for a Broadway production, right?
Right.
Right.
Of, I think, a Broadway production, but I think it began as a ballet,
mm-hmm.
Choreographed by Jerome Robbins.
Right.
And the name of the ballet eludes me at the moment.
Was that Fancy Free? Or
that's it, Fancy Free.
Yeah. Yeah,
and then
turned into a movie five years later. But with the movie, what's so interesting is almost none of the music was taken from the original production.
Three numbers of the original
are
in the movie. And that's because they didn't like Bernstein's music. And Bernstein himself boycotted the movie. He wouldn't go see it.
Now, you had experiences with Bernstein. Did he ever talk about kind of what his frustrations were like in that particular?
No. In my experience with Bernstein, he never discussed things like that.
Mm-hmm.
He was there. This was when I was a student at Tanglewood.
Mm-hmm.
And he was there for 3 weeks,
mm-hmm.
as one of our teachers. And all it was lessons,
mm-hmm.
and the music at hand. Nothing about his past experience
okay.
or anything like that.
All right. And what were your impressions of him as a teacher at the time?
Well, he was just phenomenal. I can't tell you what a great one of the greatest experiences of my life,
mm-hmm.
was the day I had my lesson with him. And it's a funny story in that when we were told, you know, he's arriving tomorrow, our daily conducting teacher, who was a very fine conductor, Gustav Meyer, made up the schedule of all of the students in what order we would go, and he said, in order to get everybody in this week, everyone's going to get 20 minutes. And he turned to me and he said, Dolbashian, you're first. And I just thought, oh my God. Of course, I didn't sleep that night.
Right.
And I was up all night studying. And then we get to the Kuzovitsky house on the grounds of Tanglewood where the lessons took place,
mm-hmm.
and everyone is just abuzz that Bernstein's on his way. And here he comes. He drives up in this classic Mercedes convertible, top down, sunglasses, cigarette in hand, and license plate reads Maestro One. And he gets out, and like everyone is just like stunned to see Leonard Bernstein in the flesh. So we get into the room, and he goes, Gustav, who's first? He turns to me and goes, go up. So I had my lesson on Brahms' Fourth Symphony.
Did everybody have the same lesson, or everyone was
everyone
different?
Had a different piece.
Oh, okay.
And mine was Brahms' Four.
Okay.
And we started. And we went. And we went. And he was just wonderful in that, explaining everything, how this note leads to that note, this harmony creates this result, the orchestration does this, it leads here, it does this, and I'm just I've got blinders on and I'm just listening to everything. He's not
trying to take it all in.
Take
right?
it all in and now conduct this. No, 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 that's not right. Do it this way. Try it again. No, 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 no. And finally he goes, that's it. That's it. You got it. That's right. So, and I'm just like, I got another planet. And finally he turns to Gustav Meyer and he says, Gustav, do you think we should stop? Is our time up? And Meyer said, yes, you've been up there for an hour and a half.
Oh, my goodness. And you were supposed to have 20 minutes?
20 minutes. And I thought, thank God I went first. Because after that, they were very strict about the 20 minute.
So that's something that stays with you literally forever.
Forever.
Yeah.
And the other thing is sort of humorous is, believe it or not, any listeners have seen me in public, they know I'm short. If you can believe it, I was taller than Leonard Bernstein. I couldn't believe how short he was, because he's like a giant.
Well, right, the commanding presence. You read about it all the time.
And you saw him on television and conducting, and he looked like a giant. And he walked in, and I thought, I mean, I have a picture of our lesson, and he's got his arm on my shoulder, and his arm is like quite high getting over my shoulder.
That's great.
So it was quite remarkable.
So let's talk about this piece, because we have these dances that are basically about the adventures of these sailors who are in New York for
a 24-hour
leave.
Yeah,
and talk about how the music and the dances were performing, kind of capture that feel.
Well, you know what's interesting, too, is like the Bernstein, you got a very big city, busy traffic, fast-moving sounds to it with what he wrote. And very rhythmic, of course, as most music depicting a city is, because of all the city noises. And written for a smaller orchestra than the Gershwin. That's not a symphonic orchestra.
Right.
Because it was a musical, it was written for a pit orchestra, where a lot of musicians in the wind section double.
In fact, you and I were talking about the fact that in these three dances, there are no bassoons.
No.
Which is very interesting.
Right, because in the pit orchestra, there weren't.
Right.
And, for example, the first clarinet doubles E-flat clarinet.
Mm-hmm.
The second clarinet doubles saxophone. The third clarinet doubles bass clarinet. So there's a lot of doubling going on, which was standard for a theater orchestra. In fact, that orchestra of On the Town is larger than most pit orchestras, which they thought was quite a coup for the show to be able to be allowed to have an orchestra
to pay all those musicians.
Right. But nevertheless, it's a reduced orchestration.
So you're a New Yorker by background. So talk about kind of how this makes you feel, because clearly it relates directly to your childhood.
Yes, but one of the things is New York of the 40s, 50s, and I was in New York. I was born in 50s, so 50s, 60s, 70s. New York was one way then. New York is not like that now.
It's not just 20 sailors on a 24-hour leave.
No. Trying to get in a week's worth of tourist activity in 24 hours.
Right.
No, New York is very different. Although I grew up at a time when I think New York was really fine, and I'm glad I grew up in New York.
Mm-hmm.
But the way things are now, I'm very happy to be here, and I really have grown to very much enjoy living out here.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
And for those who don't know, because we didn't talk about it, Maestro Dovbashian conducted the University of Missouri Columbia Orchestras for 30 years. Yes?
33.
Okay.
Yes.
I don't want to, I don't want to give short shrift to those other 3 years. So, and just as I asked you about Gershwin, talk a little bit about Bernstein and kind of what are some of your other favorite pieces of his?
Well, he wrote so much varied music, even more so than Gershwin, that straight classical music, straight chamber music, jazz, the shows.
Mm-hmm. A mass.
The West Side Story, which still is performed almost daily somewhere around the world. Tremendous amount of vocal music and just every kind of music you can imagine he wrote. And in my experience of conducting pieces that stand as symphonic dances from West Side Story, which is an absolutely magnificent piece of writing.
It is.
The Chichester Psalms, which is also another magnificent piece of writing. Overture to Candide stands out. There are just several pieces that are just are glorious by themselves in each genre that he wrote in.
What did he do to kind of move symphonic music forward in America? I mean, he had his very popular series for young people and from a music education perspective, what did he do for advancing symphonic and orchestral music?
Well, in the last century, I don't think there was a greater music educator anywhere on the planet. Mm-hmm. He could talk about music and make anyone who didn't even know how to read music listen and enjoy and learn something. I mean, those young people's concerts were on network television. Mm-hmm. CBS, I'll never forget because I used to watch it all the time.
Right.
CBS.
And it wasn't football, right?
And it wasn't football. It was CBS Sunday afternoons, mm-hmm. early evening, 6 o'clock maybe. And there you see it, right there on television, a symphony orchestra. And he had a whole series of these concerts that were very popular. And each one had a title about something, you know, what is jazz? What is rhythm? What's a concerto? Who is Stravinsky?
Right.
And he managed to reduce it to terms that whether you knew a lot about music or nothing about music, it was you learned a lot.
Yeah.
Whether you knew anything about it or didn't know anything about it.
Yeah.
He communicated. He was an incredible communicator. And with his very sort of visual way of conducting, with the very large gestures and motion on the podium, it became a visual art with mm-hmm. him, so that people were just awestruck just by watching, even if you weren't listening.
Now you have some of the conductors, you know, who come from this very staid tradition where there's a wall between the audience and the orchestra, and you know, the idea of turning around and talking to them,
right.
you know, would have been unheard of. Like
right.
I grew up, you know, attending the Chicago Symphony,
yeah.
and Schulte would never have,
no.
not in a million years.
No, no,
Bernstein was the opposite. But you, you like to engage and have a discussion with the audience.
Yes, I think there is that distance. The audience is pretty far away,
mm-hmm.
And it's nice to talk to them. I've always had a desire to actually put the audience on the stage mm-hmm. with the orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
As many as we could get,
mm-hmm.
because there's a whole different sense of what's going on stage when you're on stage, when you can really feel more of the energy, you can see the physical work of the players and the conductor.
Mm-hmm.
I think it gets them closer to the inside of what's going on.
And while we haven't done that yet, we have done things like have our Parkway Middle School students perform on stage
right.
side by side with the adults, so
yes.
they could get a feel for what
get
that's
a feel
like.
For it, what lies ahead.
Yes,
and that's always a good thing to do.
So, but now that you've said it, I think we'll figure out a way to get that audience up on stage.
Yeah.
And then we have T.J. Muller performing with us,
right?
And this is part of our continuing effort to kind of partner with other kinds of musical and performing arts groups.
Right.
So talk about kind of the benefits to the community of groups of different ilks kind of performing together.
Well, he's somewhat of a unique musician here in town. He's British,
mm-hmm.
and he came here and he was very taken with the St. Louis style of jazz, mm-hmm. blues, ragtime, particularly in the very early part of the 20th century. And that's what he loves to play.
Mm-hmm.
And his Gaslight group
mm-hmm.
is focuses on that repertoire. And it is a lost repertoire that you don't hear very often.
Mm-hmm.
But it's got some great songs, great style
mm-hmm.
that should be heard. And we're very happy that he is bringing it back, so
yeah,
to speak.
Exactly.
And making people aware of this great tradition of St. Louis jazz.
What does it mean to audience members and community members when you get two groups together that really come from very different places in terms of their artistic endeavors? I mean, a couple years ago, we performed with the Brothers Lazaroff Rock
right.
Ensemble, and then last year with the Jazz Edge Big Band.
Right.
And then in May, we're going to perform with Miss Jubilee and the Humdingers, another kind of jazz-infused group. So talk about that, what those collaborations bring to the audience and listeners that maybe they wouldn't otherwise receive.
Well, I think it makes people realize that all music gets along with each other. There is no conflict, so to speak, that with a few modifications, everything works very well together, whether you're a jazz group, a big band group, a small vocal group, a full symphony orchestra. There are ways to combine all of that, because all music is art. All music is a form of communication. And we're all speaking the same language. So there's something very natural about bringing all of this together occasionally to create some music together. And of course, you can always go back and do your separate things, but it's just a demonstration that we all get along.
I was at the St. Louis Symphony last night to see the performance of the original Star Wars movie with the symphony.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And I mean, those kinds of performances, you know, have been fairly debated, you know, in more traditional orchestral circles. But one thing is for sure, they definitely introduce people who might not otherwise have ever stepped foot in Powell Hall, you know, to large-scale symphonic music. So talk
correct.
About that a little bit.
That's good. Sometimes I think it's great. There is a downside in some circles, and I can understand that.
Sure.
That it doesn't allow, when you combine visual with the music, it very often doesn't allow the music to stand on its own.
This was kind of, if I can interrupt, this was kind of one of the arguments against Fantasia, right? It's like, now that that's in my head, I cannot create my own thing in my head.
Right. And like the Lone Ranger thing.
Lone Ranger,
you know, it's to this day, every time I hear the William Tell Overture, I just think of the Masked Ranger from way back when. And in other words, some people believe, and I believe this too, that the art of listening can get lost a bit when you continually combine a visual aspect to it. In my view, I think that's what's wrong with pop music today.
Mm-hmm.
Is ever since the 80s when videos
started,
MTV started, I think the music gradually declined, because without the visual, you turn the visual off, the music wasn't very good.
Right. And I mean, we have a long history in symphonic music of tone poems and other kinds of thought and dream inducing pieces like Scheherazade or whatever, whatever it is, Stravinsky you mentioned before, you know, and when that is imprinted on your brain in a particular way, it's hard to make it go away.
That's the hard part, is that everyone has their own imagination, which is what's great about pure music. And you can create your own images, your own colors, your own story, your own emotion while you're listening.
Mm-hmm.
But when you have the visual representation, it's almost like being told, this is what it means.
Right.
And that's not really the case. That's what it could mean to somebody.
Right.
May not mean that to me. So sometimes I'd rather have my own imagination go wild than to be influenced by a visual.
Edward, we're almost out of time. Is there anything else you wanted to share about the upcoming concert?
No, I think it's a great concert. It's great music. And I hope everyone comes out to enjoy this this presentation of American jazz music from the early part of the 20th century. And I think everyone will have a good time.
Me too. And thanks, everybody, for listening. And on behalf of Edward, this is Larry Levin from the St. Louis Civic Orchestra. And we look forward to seeing you on February 23rd at Logan. For more details, check out our website, stlco.org, or our Facebook page for the St. Louis Civic Orchestra. Thanks and take care. Bye-bye.